for their partnership and for hosting us in this special event. Thank you all for coming here. I'd like to thank Rabbi Zatzon for coordinating the event. And it's very special for us to have Rabbi Moshe Walter here this morning to lecture for us from Woodside. Rabbi Walter is a dear friend, and somebody that we're very lucky as a community to have amongst our rabbis. Rabbi Walter brings a unique and special passion to learning and to Yahadus. This past Chanukah, I usually don't buy presents for myself, but sometimes I do when I really feel like I need something. And I went to the Sun store and I got the Making of Halachic Decision that was authored by Rabbi Walter, and started to read it. And it's clear that Rabbi Walter not only is the first-rate scholar, but has a unique ability and gift to take complex matters and to present them lucidly and clearly. And it's a great honor to have Rabbi Walter here lecture us on this very interesting topic. I did get a couple of comments that people hope that it doesn't become relevant in a personal way, but it's very fascinating, and thank you, Rabbi Walter.
Good morning to everybody. Open by thanking our host, the Young Yezov Shom Emunah, the Rav, Rabbi David Rosenbaum, for hosting not only this event, but opening up the shul to numerous activities, programs, lectures, and shiurim. It's really a fantastic opportunity that I have to really be part and parcel of the shul. Secondly, thank you very much to Rabbi Winter, the Rosh Kollel of the Greater Washington Community Kollel, who, as we are all aware, has brought numerous exciting lectures, programs, to not only to White Oak, but certainly many of us have gained from. You know, my family are certainly recipients of all the wonderful events that take place in White Oak and throughout the Greater Washington community, so for that we are all indebted, and thank you very much for that. There are handouts going around. There should be the 3 pages of handouts, which are all stapled. The title of the lecture is Falling on a Grenade, Voluntary Self-Sacrifice in Jewish Law. The first source really explains this concept, falling on a grenade, which is not necessarily a colloquial term, but it's a very real and certainly a textbook term. Falling on a grenade, if you take a look, the simplest, easiest definition is from the Wikipedia Encyclopedia. Writes as follows, source number one, falling on a grenade refers to a deliberate act of using one's body to cover a live, time-fused hand grenade, absorbing the explosion fragmentation in an effort to save the lives of others nearby. Since this is almost universally fatal, it is considered an especially conspicuous and selfless act of individual sacrifice in wartime. In the United States military history, more citations for the Medal of Honor have been awarded for falling on grenades to save comrades than any other single act. That's the definition and the concept of falling on a grenade. I'd like to point out 3 different cases, 2 of them you're most probably familiar with, that seem to etch out and to explain to us and describe scenarios that we have heard about or are familiar with of individuals who were very, very brave and indeed fell on a grenade. The second source is from the Times, 2008, June 3rd. President Bush, this is source number 2, awarded the military's highest honor posthumously on Monday to a 19-year-old soldier who was killed in Iraq after falling on a grenade to save his fellow soldiers. At a White House ceremony, the president presented the award to Romaine and Thomas McGinnis, the parents of the soldier, Private Officer Ross A. McGinnis of the Army. Times goes on to briefly recount the details of his falling on a grenade. In the second paragraph in source number 2, Private McGinnis of Knoxville, Pennsylvania, was killed in a Baghdad neighborhood on December 4, 2006, when a grenade was thrown into the gunner's hatch of the Humvee in which he was driving. Mr. Bush noted that Private McGinnis had enough time to jump out and save himself. This can be very crucial in terms of analyzing halachically what is the rubric and the construct of this law. But here, Private McGinnis indeed had enough time, keep that in mind, to jump out and save himself. He could have left. Instead, however, The Times reports he dropped into the hatch and covered the grenade with his own body, absorbing the fragments. He was killed instantly. All four of his fellow soldiers were saved. Four men are alive because this soldier embodied our army values and gave his life. So as opposed to Private McGinnis being able to run for his life and save himself, he indeed jumped on this grenade, losing his life, and as in light of that, saving the lives of four other soldiers. The way I came onto this topic was from source number three, a very well-known case when I was living in Israel, which not only made Israeli headlines, but certainly world headlines, regarding a soldier who we're all familiar with, Roei Klein. This is David Gutman. David Gutman seems to have had the most explicit details of what exactly took place. He was not one of the individuals who was there when, indeed, Roei Klein was killed. But here is the facts of the story that took place. Many of you might be familiar with it. For us, this is seemingly the most important case because here we're talking about a Jew. Major Roei Klein, 31 years old, of the Golani Brigade from the settlement Eli, was among the highest-ranking officer among his combatants at Ben Jabil. He noticed a grenade thrown toward his men. As it was too late to protect them, he threw his whole body on the grenade so that he would absorb most of the impact and save his men. So similarly to Private McGinnis, Roei Klein as well was familiar and knew that he could leave and would be able to run for his life. Instead, he threw his whole body on the grenade and absorbed most of the impact in order to save his men. The report, as David Gutman remarked, his sacrifice worked. His men had survived that he yelled out Shema Yisrael at the moment he jumped on the grenade and asked his communications officer to notify headquarters about his death before he closed his eyes. Roei Klein, a true hero in a time when heroism is not valued, was buried on his 31st birthday. This story, when it took place, was really took the entire country, overwhelming took the entire country. And Israel is not a place where death is uncommon, but this story, for some reason, as is clear, is very emotional. He had left behind a wife and two young children, two young sons. And I'd like to analyze, in light of the very difficult emotionally, to talk about it and to discuss it, it's important to understand and recognize that halacha does deal with these circumstances as well. The fourth case, before we get into the guts of the issue, is the case on 9/11, which you're all familiar with as well. But this case is also very important and has brought to light a lot of halachic issues as well. I'll read with you together source number four. Huddled in the back of the plane, the passengers and crew of Flight 93 made a series of calls on their cell phones and the in-flight air phones, informing family members and officials on the ground of the plane's hijacking. This, by the way, is the fourth plane that left, I believe, from San Francisco, and it was headed, questionably, everybody has different details as where they thought they headed, it could be to the White House, but when they learned the fate of the three other hijacked flights in New York and Washington, D.C., the passengers realized that their plane was involved in a larger terrorist plot and would likely be used to carry out further attacks on U.S. soil. Somehow they were able to put that together, and they understood that their plane was headed toward another major American establishment. After a brief discussion, a vote was taken, and the passengers decided to fight back against their hijackers, informing several people on the ground of their plans. One of the passengers, Thomas Burnett Jr., told his wife over the phone, "I know we're all going to die. The three of us are going to do something about it. I love you, honey." Another passenger, Todd Beamer, was heard over an open line saying, "Are you guys ready? Let's roll." Sandy Bradshaw, a flight attendant, called her husband and explained that she had slipped into the galley and was filling pitchers with boiling hot water. Her last words to him, "Everybody's running to first class. I've got to go by." Final paragraph, source number four, if you turn the page. At 9:57, the passengers and crew aboard Flight 93 began their counterattack, as recorded by the cockpit voice recorder. In response, the hijacker piloting the plane began to roll the aircraft, pitching it up and down to throw the chargers off balance. Clearly, there was an understanding that there was a fight back from the passengers. Worried that the passengers would soon break through the cockpit, the hijackers made the decision to crash the plane before reaching their final destination. At 10:02, a voice was recorded saying, "Yes, pull it in, pull it down." Several other voices chanted, "Allah is great," as the plane's controls were turned hard to the right. The airplane then rolled onto its back and plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania at 580 miles per hour. administered by the National Park Service, encompassing more than 2,220 acres. The memorial will eventually include a visitor center, memorial tree grove, a mile-wide field of honor, and the crash site itself known as Sacred Ground, the final resting place of the heroes of Flight 93. The four sources that we just saw opened up with clearly all indicate that the act which these two individuals, and certainly the entire plane on Flight 93 were acts of heroism. Both Roe Klein, Private McGinnis, as well, and certainly the flight attendants on Flight 93 headed from San Francisco to Washington gave their lives in an effort to save the lives of others. I would like to discuss today specifically the issue of giving one's life in order to save others. As difficult as it is an issue, it is something that we have to address, discuss, and talk about. And in light of that, I hope to return back to these four sources to analyze and understand how it is and what they did do. Was it appropriate? Was it not appropriate? And what are the rules and how to analyze certain like situations? The first source of rabbinic literature, which describes and discusses these cases, can be found in source number 5. Source number 5 is a classic Gemara found in Masechet Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph. There, the Gemara, Perek Ben Sorer Amora, discusses the three cardinal sins of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shefichus Damim. That is idolatry, illicit relations, and murder. Any of those three acts, cardinal sins, if one is put in a situation, is challenged, is forced into doing one of those three acts, one's life must be given up. That means he or she who is put in a situation where they are forced to commit avodah zarah, to bow down to an idol, to be involved in illicit relations, or to murder somebody else. The rule is, the Torah rule is, yahareg ve'al ya'avor, which means that I, he, she, my life has to be given before committing myself to falling prey to those three sins. The Gemara, as it always does, tries to trace the source of the rulings, and the Gemara first deals with Rotseach. Rotseach means Shvichus Damim. How do I know? What's the source? Is there a text source to prove that that is what is appropriate? The Gemara asks the third word, it's a little bit cut. Rotseach Gufe Minolam. What is the source as to how, why one cannot fall prey to Rotseach? I can't kill somebody else in order to save my life. The Gemara answers two words, Svarahu, the logical deduction. Often the Gemara tries to bring textual proof, sometimes the Gemara tries to bring logical deductions to answer a question. Here the Gemara explains that it's a svara. What's the svara? The hahu da'asu l'kameh d'rabba. Somebody came to ask a shayla of the great Talmudic sage Rabba. V'amar lani posed the following practical, real-life situation that was taking place. And this individual came to Rabba and told him, Amar lani mari duroi. Mari duroi, Rashi explains to us, as an individual, was a chief, was an officer, was a city controller, was an evildoer. Rashi does. I've never seen Mari duroi anywhere else in Shas. He seems to be an evil, wicked man, seems to be of Roman descent. Rashi doesn't write that. But Mari duroi put this individual into the following situation. Zil, katle leplanya, vilo katil malach. Go, kill. This individual, Mari Durai, said to his fellow over here, we don't know who the Jewish person we're talking about was, go kill this other person. If not, I'm going to kill you. So Mari Durai put this person into a very difficult circumstance, and we'll call him Reuven, and Mari Durai tells Reuven, Reuven, go kill Shimon. If you don't kill Shimon, I'm going to kill you. What's Rabba's response to this individual? Amar Lei, Rabba responds, Liktilach velo tikto. Better that you be killed and don't kill somebody else. So if we're talking about Reuven here, Rabba tells Reuven, Reuven, your life should be taken and don't take the life of another individual in order to save yourself. Now, Rabba explains a well-known Jewish dictum, and Rabba is the source of it. Mi yemar de dama didach sumak tvei, dilma dama de hahu gavra sumak tvei. So it's since become a very well-known Jewish concept, to translate it colloquially. Who says your blood is redder than mine? So when Rabba was questioned as to whether or not he should give his life or not, the Gemara answers, Rabba's response is, no, you can't do that, Reuven. It's not up to you to decide if your life is more precious than Shimon. That's not of Jewish value. Jewish value teaches that all of us are created equal. We are all the same. Reuven doesn't have the right to decide that his life is more important, is more valuable, is redder than Shimon. So as such, if Murray Durai originally came to Reuven and told Reuven, I'm going to kill you, and if you don't kill Shimon, then your life is over, the Gemara says that Reuven has to give up his life. So source number 5 clearly indicates that all Jews are created equal. No differentiation is made whatsoever between the greatest rabbinic sage and the peddler. Every individual is the same. If this was true, that if somebody came over to the greatest rabbinic sage, the Gadol Ador, and told him that you have to be killed unless you kill the little peddler who makes a few kopecks a day, the rabbinic sage's life has to be taken. He has no right to kill the other person. That's source number 5. Your blood is no redder than anybody else. In light of that, let's see source number 6, and please keep in mind what we just mentioned in source number 5. Third word in source number 6, Kidetanya. The Gemara in Bava Metzia and Daf Samach Beis relates a fascinating dialogue, discussion and debate between two great Talmudic sages, Ben Petur and Rabbi Akiva. This piece of Gemara has been taken by great ethicists throughout world history and has become debated and discussed. You might be familiar from Gemara, you might be familiar from secondary sources. The Gemara has the following scenario. Shnayim shehayim halchem b'derech. There are two people walking along a path. Ubiyat echa ben kiton shalmayim. One of the individuals has with him a flask of water. Im shosim shnehem esit. If there's a split of this bottle of Avion Poland spring water, they'll both die. Vim shosim echa mehem magil yishuv. If one of them is going to drink the entire flask, the entire 2 ounces of Poland Spring, his life will be spared. He will be able to return to civilization and seemingly be able to be saved. What do we do? Better that they both drink and both die? Or better that one individual drinks and that individual will be saved and as such will be able to return to civilization? The Gemara first introduces Ben Petura. Ben Petura responds, Mutav shiyishtu shtehem. Better that they both drink. They should split this flask of water. V'yamusu, they'll both die. V'alyira echad mehen b'misoso shel chavera. And one should not see the death of his partner, of his colleague, of his friend, of his colleague. Inappropriate, says Ben Petura. There's the opportunity for both of them to drink. Let them both drink. They're both going to die. Well, that's not up to us to decide. Again, whose life is more important? Let them both drink. Then the Gemara says, another position. And it points out to you, it's interesting how the Gemara indicates, classically in the Gemara has a debate between two, either Tanaim or Amraim, it states both of their opinions. Here the Gemara introduces, Ad Shabar Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva came along. And Rabbi Akiva made the following statement, V'limed v'chai echech imach, Rabbi Akiva cites the Pasuk in Parshas Emor, you shall live amongst your brother. Rabbi Akiva understands that Pasuk to mean, Chayecha kodmin l'chai chavercha. Your life Trump supersedes and is more important than the other. So Rabbi Kiva and Ben Petura argue and debate what to do in this situation. One flask of water, one bottle of water, two people are there, two people have the opportunity to drink from it. Should they split it or should one person drink it? One person will be able to return to civilization, two of them will die. The Gemara does not clearly indicate a psak halacha. And rabbinic authorities debate, and the truth is the Rishonim, this is not Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, what to do in this particular situation. There's much discussion, much has been written about the position of the Rambam, how he deals with this situation. But it seems to be, based upon the way the Gemara introduces Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Akiva indeed is the final say on the matter, Ad Shabar Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva comes along, and Rabbi Akiva teaches, Chai Achach Imach, that Chayecha Kodmin, my life is more important than yours. Let's just analyze this Gemara a bit carefully and try to understand it in light of source number 5. In this scenario, source number 6, it seems that one person is holding on to the bottle of water. Right? If you read the Gemara again in the second line, Biyad echad mehen kiton shalmayim. One of them has a flask of water. When one person has a flask of water, the other does not have a flask of water, that's the Gemara's discussion. And in that situation where one person has a flask of water, then that person has the right to hold on to that water, according to Rabbi Akiva, and does not have to split it with his friend. Parenthetically, the Gemara and later Poskim use this case into very contemporary, interesting cases regarding application of scarce resources, for example, when it comes to organ transplantation, when there's only a specific amount of a liver, if it's a particular organ that there's a long list for, so who has the rights, who should be receiving it first? And certainly in a situation what we refer to as third-party life-saving, when there's a specific amount of a particular organ that's available, so here that might not be applicable for the case that we're dealing with, because here it belongs to the person. That's what the Gemara is talking about. One person owns it. So when it comes to applying this Gemara to third-party life-saving, when there are 100 organs that are available, 100 codes that are available to be used for transplantation, or when it gets more severe, so the question is whether or not this Gemara is applicable or not. Where Moshe Feinstein does apply this Gemara is when it comes to an end-of-life situation where somebody is on a life support system. Let's say the person is very, very old and there's very small chance of him living particularly long. He has a week or two, three left. The question that's often asked, and many great Gedolei Poskim address this question, are you permitted to take the person off of that life support in order to give it to a 22-year-old who was just in a car accident, and the chances of him surviving, if with life support, are very, very high. However, you're going to have to pull the life support over the person who's 110 years old. Is that appropriate or not? Moshe Feinstein writes unequivocally that that is aser, that's prohibited. Once a person is living, once a person is alive, like the case over here of Rabbi Kiva, where I have the water, I own the bottle of water, I don't have to give it up. I'm not permitted to give it up. The Tzitzel Yezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, responded to an emergency room doctor, a chief in the emergency room in South Africa, telling him the same thing. And based upon this Gemara, if a person is already on life support, there's no permission to remove one from life support. What I would like to address here in source number 6, which is quite different than source number 5, is here the Gemara does seem to point out that there is hierarchy when it comes to life-saving. Source number 6 clearly explains that I have a bottle of water. If somebody has a bottle of water, I don't have to give it up. My life trumps it. So indeed, the Gemara does not seem to be in line with the last statement. There the Gemara said all of us are created equal. So why is it if all of us are created equal, my dhamma didach sumak fei, dhamma dhamma, dehahu gavra sumak fei, maybe your life is better, my life is better, we don't know. Here the Gemara seems to point out that if I have the bottle of water, it's up to me to drink it and somebody else can't drink it. If you take a look at each of the two Gemaras, there would seem to be a way to differentiate between the two cases. When it comes to deciding or giving a death sentence to somebody, that's not my decision. I can't make the decision whether or not your blood is redder than my blood. Reuven, when he was asked by Mari Duray for him to give up his life, and if not, he's going to kill Shimon. So here Reuven is in a situation where he is playing God. When he is deciding, should I kill Shimon or should I kill myself? When it comes to a situation where I am making a life decision, where I am playing God, I don't have any rights to do that. However, when it comes to keeping myself alive, when it comes to a situation where I'm able to save myself proactively, then I have to say, like the first Gemara says, I can't do anything. I'm not in that decision. But when I'm passively acting, when I'm passively an individual who's trying to keep myself alive, that's what the Gemara is saying in source number 6. So there's a certain discrepancy or a difference that can be made between pointing to somebody's life to killing somebody else as source number 5. That we always use the age-old Talmudic dictum and concept, who says your blood is redder than mine? It's not up to me to decide if your blood is redder or my blood is redder. If I was brought to Mari Duray and my life was at risk, I have to give up my life. But when it comes to saving myself, there is rules of hierarchy. You might be familiar with the Gemara and the Mishnayos and the Maseches Harios point out there certainly are areas of hierarchy. A Kohen comes before a lady becomes before Yisrael. Two people are drowning, and there's only a lifeboat that could hold on to one person. In that situation, I have to make a decision whose life to keep alive, to maintain. That's different than source number 5 when I'm pointing to somebody's death. So here we always have to get ourselves in a situation, this is where the area becomes a little bit gray, whether this is a situation of life-saving, like when I'm on the air and I'm coming down from the pilot is coming down from his helicopter, and he only has one person to take up. Who is he going to take up? He has to make that life decision. There he could decide based upon a set of rules and precedents, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, and I'm not getting into the different situations there specifically, but that's what we call a life situation. When it comes to saving somebody's life, in that particular situation, there is a set of hierarchy. When it comes to the opposite situation, where I am deemed and I have a death sentence upon me, it's not up to me to point fingers to somebody else. That's the background, the way I understood Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman in his classic work, Kovid Shiurim, he differentiates between these two Gemaras in this exact way. One of the reasons that I decided to talk about this topic when I was discussing with Rabbi Winter was because of source number 7. Source number 7 is a pasuk in this coming week's parsha. Sefer Shmos opens up with us being introduced to Moshe Rabbeinu, the great savior of the Jewish people. And Moshe Rabbeinu has introduced us as a person who looks for social justice, an individual who is very, very careful in making sure nobody is ever harmed, nobody's life is at danger. Moshe notices early on in his life a mitzri, an Egyptian, fighting, beating up on a Jew. And Rashi already points out that Moshe noticed, was aware that somebody was in a difficult situation, not an ein of the libo. Moshe put his heart and his eyes upon this individual to save him. We're familiar with the results of that incident. Moshe kills the mitzri. V'yitzmenehu b'chol, Moshe buries him in the sand. And as such, Moshe begins his life as a person of proactive social justice, making sure that the Jewish people are safe and are being protected. Some psukim later, we are introduced to another argument, another fight. Shnei anashim nitzim. Two people are fighting. Anytime you see shnei anashim in the Torah, either in Sefer Shmos and Sefer B'midbar, it's often referring to Dathan ve'Aviram. And here indeed, we're familiar from Rashi, these shnei anashim, these two individuals, are Dathan ve'Aviram, two characters who sort of follow the Jewish people throughout the Midbar, always getting themselves in trouble. And here we begin, the first time they're introduced to Dathan ve'Aviram, they're fighting amongst themselves. And Moshe Rabbeinu notices this fight. And upon Moshe Rabbeinu coming to Dathan ve'Aviram and trying to break up the fight, one of them responds, "Are you going to kill us like you killed the mitzri?" And Moshe is frightened, and as a result of word leaking that Moshe is this person who is meeting out justice, he flees and runs for his life and heads to Midian. And Pasuk Yates, the Torah tells us, as the Jewish people in the interim are sent to Mitzrayim and are in exile, God charges Moshe Rabbeinu with the following. V'yomer Hashem el Moshe, source number 7, Pasuk Yates, b'Midyan. Moshe is in Midyan, that's where he's residing as a result of his fleeing from this situation where he's left in a very, very complicated situation. Lech shuv Mitzrayim. Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, go return to Egypt. And it's the end of the Pasuk that I would like to bring to your attention. The Torah tells us, ki mesu kol ha'anashim ha'mevakshim es nafshecha. All the people that are looking for your life, that want you dead, are no longer alive. One of the great classic commentaries, Achronim on the Torah, the great 19th century luminary of Meir Simchav Devinsk, author of the Sefer Meshe Chachma, asks a phenomenal question on the end of this pasuk. Why does the Torah have to tell us that all the people who want Moshe's life are no longer alive? What's the significance of the Torah pointing out that all the people that wanted Moshe dead as a result of his activities are no longer alive? The Torah could have simply told us Moshe's charge is indeed to return to Egypt to free the Jewish people. What's important about the Torah teaching and telling me that all the people who want Moshe alive, or that want Moshe dead, are no longer alive? Take a look at source number 8. This is the Meshe Chachma. Muchach, says the Meshe Chachma, Dimhoyu chayim hamavakshim es nafsha. Were the people to have been alive, those people who wanted, who had a death march on Moshe Rabbeinu, who wanted his life taken, if those people indeed were alive, says the Meshe Chachma, lohoya sarich leilech lahotzi bnei Yisrael mitzrayim, Moshe would not have had the commandment, would not have had to return to Egypt to save the Jewish people from Mitzrayim. Even though everybody needed Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was the savior. Was going to bring the salvation of the Jewish people. And because the fact that those people may have been alive, and because they wanted Moshe dead, that's why the Torah goes to the extent to tell us that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu that they're not alive anymore. Because if they would have been alive, Moshe could have stayed in Midian, could have sat back and did not have the responsibility in that situation to return to Egypt. Says the Meshe Chachma, and these are the important words, Eino tzarech lehachnis atzmo b'sakana. Moshe did not have to put himself into a situation of danger in order to save the Jewish people. A striking chiddush of Rav Meir Simcha. He continues, and he also has a commentary on the Rambam, his well-known commentary, the Or Sameach, and this part, this snippet, he repeats there as well, in the seventh parak of Hilchos Ritzicha, And here the Meir Simcha says, "Umiyezeh yasel Rabbeinu." Here says Rabbi Meir Simcha of Divinsk is where the Rambam deduces the following fact from the Mishnah regarding an Ir Miklat, a city of refuge, an individual who killed somebody accidentally is permitted to enter a city of refuge. He will not be killed if he finds himself in safety in the city of refuge. And the Mishnah and the Rambam articulate this in his magnum opus, the Yad HaChazaka, writes, Shagol al Ir Miklat, somebody who is exiled to an Ir Miklat, Eino Yosei lo Leidus Mitzvah, he is not permitted, does not have to leave the city of refuge, even if he has to testify for a particular mitzvah to save somebody's life. V'lo le'edus mamu, not to testify for a financial matter. V'lo le'edus nefashos, not even to save somebody's life as a testimony to somebody else. V'afilu, says the Rambam, Yisrael tzrichimo, even if the entire congregation of Israel needs this individual who's stuck in the city of refuge, v'afilu sarat tzav Yisrael k'yov ben tzriya, even David's great general, Yoav ben Tzruya, were he to find himself in the city of refuge, would not be permitted to flee, would not be permitted to find himself in the city of refuge. He has to remain there. And that the Rambam says, Einu yotzi misham la'olam, asher nof shama, that's what the Pasuk says, sham tehei diraso, sham tehei misaso, somebody's in the city of refuge, that's where they are forever. Here, Rav Meir Simcha Midevinsk makes a startling comment that even though I can save somebody else, I don't have to put myself into a situation of danger to save another individual. What Rav Meir Simcha doesn't address in this particular piece is, what about a suffix sakana? What about, I'm not sure if there is a danger particularly or not in order to save somebody else. Although he doesn't discuss it here in the Meshech Chachm, he does pick up on it in his Sefer Or Sameach, as I pointed out earlier, in his Sefer Or Sameach on the Rambam, in the 7th paragraph of Hilchos Tzitzicha, there Rav Meir Simcha goes as far as to say that even if you're in a suffix sakana, even if there's a doubt, 50-50, if Moshe was returned to Mitzrayim, maybe they would have been alive, maybe they would not have been alive, says the Meshech Chachma, Moshe would not have had to return to Mitzrayim. And for us, contemporarily, if we find ourselves in a situation of sakana, or suffix sakana, says Rabbi Meir Simcha of Divinsk, one would not be permitted to set up a situation to save somebody's life in that predicament. Rav Meir Simcha has a tremendous chiddush, and the chiddush is really in light of a halacha that we find in Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat. You take a look on source number 9, page number 3, is the Smat, classic work on Choshen Mishpat, the Sefer Miras Einayim, commenting on Simen Tav Chavav. Simen Tav Chavav is about the rules of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa. It's a pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. The Torah tells us that one is permitted to stand idly by as you see somebody else in danger. The case that the Shulchan Aruch depicts is, if you see somebody drowning, Lo Aleinu, I can't just stand idly by. If I see somebody drowning, I have a responsibility to save that person's life. I can't watch another person's death. Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa, I cannot stand idly by watching as somebody's blood is being shed. Clearly, if I don't know how to swim, if there's a danger to me, if I'm going to walk into the water and Reuven will be killed as a result of trying to save Shimon, so Reuven doesn't have to go in the water. That's the source that we saw earlier. Rabbi Akiva said, Chayecha Kovin. If I don't know how to swim, I was never taught how to swim, which I should have been taught how to swim, but I was never taught how to swim. So I don't have any right to enter the water. I can't save his life because I'm going to die. Let's say, however, there's a suffix that comes. I'm not sure. I'm a decent swimmer. I've swam before. And I see somebody drowning. What's the rule in that situation? That's what we call a suffix sakana. Now that case, interestingly enough, not the tour, not the Shulchan Aruch don't discuss. Now this is often difficult anytime you're dealing with situations of life-saving. So the Rishonim do point out, don't be so careful. Because if we're so careful, at times we're just going to watch civilization fall apart. Many times that we read about heroes and heroines is specifically because they put themselves in a particular situation when they were trying to save somebody else and they were managed to do so. But if we're often so careful, that is quite not the best thing to do. However, what about a suffix sakana? It's a 50-50. 50% that I will die, 50% that I won't die. Am I permitted to save somebody else? So like I mentioned, the Shulchan Aruch does not address that specific situation. That is source number 9, the Sma. The Sefer Miras Einayim notes that the Shulchan Aruch, as well as in his preceding work, the Beis Yosef, his commentary on the Tur, does not note that case, but he does cite something from the Hagos Maimonios. Agos Maimonides is the classic Ashkenazic work on the Rambam, where he compiles and collects many of the psukim of the Ashkenazi Rishonim. The Rambam only brought his Piskei Halacha and didn't cite other sources. Agos Maimonides is a collection of the Ashkenazi Piskei Halacha found on the bottom of the Sefer HaRambam. And here, the Sma digs up from the Beis Yosef a psak of the Agos Maimonides dealing with that particular situation. Source number 9, over ala osamo, those words in the bold are a citation from the Shulchan Aruch, that one who stands idly by and watches somebody die when they could have been saved transgresses the negative commandment of watching somebody's life slip away. And now the Hagos Maimonides quotes, the Hagos Maimonides. Dibyushalmi, the Hagos Maimonides follows from the Jerusalem Talmud, Masi concludes, Ditzarech afilu lahachnis atzmo besafek sakana. One is even not only permitted, but is commanded to put themselves in a situation of safek sakana in order to save somebody else. That means, if I'm a decent swimmer, if I'm okay, I could pull it off, I could save an individual, says the Yushalmi, and this is what the Hagos Maimonides is quoting, I have to dive in, and I have to save the other person. What's the Svara? The Hagos Maimonides says that the Beis Yosef himself brings this. V'nireh she'atam in the second line, mipnei shehalo v'adai v'hu safek. That person is certainly in a situation of danger. I'm only in a safek. And a safek is not motzi midei v'adai. Here I have to make sure, however, that I can save the other person. I have the permission and the obligation to save that person because I might make it. And if I might make it, and that person is definitely not going to make it, so his v'adai, his certainty that he will die, trumps the fact that I might die. And that's the psak of the Hagos Maimonides. The Beis Yosef himself brings this ruling that if I may be able to save that person, it's my responsibility to head out into the deep sea and to try to save that person. Now, the Sma concludes. Gamze hishmitu hamechaber v'maharam. The Shulchan Aruch, that's of Yosef Karo, as well as the Ramar of Moshe Isserles, both do not cite this ruling of the Hagos Maimonides. That means, although the Hagos Maimonides is asking that person is certainly going to die, and I might if I go out to save him, the Shulchan Aruch never cites it. We are bound by the Shulchan Aruch and Rabbi Yosef Karo's teachings and rulings. If it's not brought there, so that's not a situation that I have to follow. Not only that, says the Sma, Ubezei Yeshlomer, we can understand, Kevin Shaposkim Harif, Veharambam Veharosh, those are the three prominent poskim that Rav Yosef Karo typically follows in order to paskin halacha, two out of the three, the Rif, the Rambam, or the Rosh, rule in one particular way. Then the Shulchan Aruch will paskin. In this situation, since the Rambam does not discuss the case of Safek Sakana, the Rif doesn't discuss the case of Safek Sakana, the Rosh doesn't discuss the case of Safek Sakana, the Tur, who is the son of the Rosh, doesn't bring this case, they left it out. We are left in a situation that I never have to put myself into a suffix sakana in order to save somebody else. So in this regard, one could come out understanding that I don't have to do anything. I stand idly by. That's what I'm supposed to do, says the Sma. They don't bring this halacha from the Yerushalmi. It's not a situation where I'm forced to put myself in the situation. Therefore, I never have to put myself into a suffix sakana in order to save somebody else. This now brings us to our cases that we've been discussing. If I don't have to put myself into a suffix sakana, if I can't risk my life at the expense of my own life to save somebody else, so am I permitted specifically to give my life when I know that my life will be taken as a result of saving somebody else? Private McGinnis knew when he was jumping on the grenade that he was going to be killed. Roe Klein told his commander standing next to him that he's going to die. Report back to headquarters that I gave my life to save my combatant. The Gemara seems very clear. The Halacha seems very clear. I can't give my life, lo samar al dam reacha, if I know that I'm going to be killed. That's the Gemara with Rabbi Akiva. I have the bottle of water. I have to drink it. Not only do I have to drink it, but I can't give it to somebody else. It belongs to me. It's my life. It's my bottle of water. I'm on the life support system. I can't give it up to somebody else, even if I leave behind a statement, take my life. That's murder. That's death. How do we understand the cases that we dealt with thus far? Source number 10 is the Gemara in Baba Basra, that many later contemporary achronim, 18th century, 19th century achronim bring in order to describe and discuss a case, what we contemporarily refer to as falling on a grenade. The Gemara says, Shamati, the third word in source number 10a, Shahayu Omrim, there were those who said, Haruge Malchus Ein Kobirya Yecholo Lama B'mechitzasa. Those who were killed by means of the government, the Malchus, the kingdom, nobody can have any place in heaven near them. They have their own special place in heaven. The Gemara doesn't tell us who these Haruge Malchus are, and the Gemara questions, Mine Ninhu, who are these Haruge Malchus? Gemara says, Ilema Rabbi Kiva v'chavera. Maybe it's referring to the 10 martyrs. Rabbi Kiva most prominently, who gave their life al Kiddush Hashem, asks the Gemara, Mishum Haruge Malchus v'sulo. That's all they are worthy of? Haruge Malchus? They get much more than that. Pshita b'lavachi. We know that already. Haruge Malchus, Rabbi Kiva, they're Kiddush Hashem. The Gemara deals with that explicitly and describes to us that Rabbi Kiva giving his life was a matter of incredible Kiddush Hashem. So the Gemara does not have to be referring to him in this pithy statement of Haruge Malchus. Rather, what is it referring to? The Gemara says, Haruge Lud. Who were the Haruge Lud? So Rashi fills us in a piece of history post the Second Temple or around Churban Bayis Sheni. A particular incident took place in Lud. The Rashi tells us in source 10b, Lulinus Upapus Achim Shaharga. There were two brothers, Lulinus and Papus. Shahargam Turnus Rufus, the Rashi here has the Girfus, that's Turnus Rufus. Others have the Girfus, that's Turnus Rufus. Another Roman evil person. But these two brothers were killed because of the following story that took place. The Ludkia, the event that took place in the city of Ludkia, which is Lud in Hebrew. Kidamrin bin Mesechus Tainis, the Gemara elaborates upon this story in the end of Mesechus Tainis. Al-Yadei Gzeira Shenigzer al-Yisrael, there was a particular degree that was given to the Jews of Lud, Lahashmid, that the entire city was to be wiped out. The entire city of Lud was to be destroyed. Al-Shenimtseis Bas Melech Haruga, the daughter of the king, was found murdered. V'choshtu es Yisrael alea, and the entire city of Lud, man, woman, child alike, were set up or were made to think, or made not to think, but certainly the king, Turnus Rufus, understood that it was the Jews who were held accountable for the death of his precious daughter. However, these two brothers, Lulinus and Papa, stepped up, V'amdu halachi malalu, these two, Lulinus and Papa, stepped up to the plate, V'amru, and said, Malachem al Yisrael, what do you want with the Jews? Anu harguha. We killed your daughter. Striking event, striking story, but the Gemara tells us that Ein kol birya yachol lama b'mechitzas, and nobody could stand where Lulinus and Papa stand because of this heroic act which they performed. The entire city of Lud was to be destroyed because of the death of this princess. Lulinus and Papa would not stand for it, and in light of their action, the entire city of Lud was saved. Lulinus and Papa went to their death. This Gemara requires a lot of analysis, a lot of understanding, certainly in light of everything we've discussed on page number 2, which clearly indicates that I can't give up my life for somebody else. I'm not permitted to give up my life for somebody else. It's usur to give up my life for somebody else. Even a suffix sakana, as the Smat posited, one is not permitted to put yourself in a suffix sakana. Here they knew, they were admitting that they were the ones who went about this deed, and they wanted their lives to be taken in respect in the light of the entire Jewish people of the city of Lod. The earliest commentary that I found who addressed this difficulty is the Yeshuas Yaakov. Yeshuas Yaakov wrote a running commentary on all four sections of Shulchan Aruch. It's a classic commentary, and in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, he deals with this particular situation and, similar to us, questions the permission, the veracity, the ability, the propriety of Lulinus and Papus permitting this particular act. Take a look in source number 11, and the Yeshuas Yaakov begins by citing a very, very big chiddush as well, a very novel concept. He admits that it's novel, and we're really left at the end of source number 11 also in a bit of a quandary how to understand his resolution to the problem. The top line, the fourth word from the end of the top line, he says the following statement, Lutovasan Shel Yisrael, for the good of the Jewish people, Yachol ha'adam limsor nafsho. For the good of the Jewish people, one is permitted to give his life. Fascinating. I didn't know that. We haven't found it in thousands of years of rabbinic literature that one is permitted to give your life for tovas and shel Yisrael. Where does the Yeshua Yaakov get this point? He points out that he writes about this in his responsa. The Hevesi mihach de haruge lud. What's his source? His source is source number 10. Haruge lud. The Amru Chazal will review the case. The Meseches Baba Basa Daf Yud. The third line. Ein shum adam zoch liyos b'mechitzas megan eden. Nobody touches their place in the world to come. Upiresh Rashi. Rashi explains the incident. The Ma'isahaya Shehelilu Basmela Shemerga. The daughter of the king was killed. The Halila Akol Kal Yisrael, and everybody ratted on the Jewish people of Lud. Shehem Hargur, that they killed her. V'amdu Elu, and these two, Luliness and Pupa, stood up. V'amushem Hargurasa. Ashlahaya came. That was a lie. Luliness and Pupa didn't kill her. But they're willing to give their life to save the Jewish people of Lud. V'hem lo Hargur, Amru Kein Lahatzilas Kal Yisrael. They did so in order to save the Jewish people. So Yeshua Yaakov himself asks our question. Why are they permitted to do such a thing? They didn't commit that act. If Reuven is asked to give his life and life give Shimon's life, he can't do that. If I'm a standerby, I'm a passerby, and somebody's about to be shot, I can't come along and say, take my life instead. That's a halacha mafurish in Shulchan Aruch. How did Luliness and Papas do that? And here the Yeshua Yaakov asks the question from a Mishnah, in Meseches Trumos, the Imam Lehem Akum, if a non-Jew comes over and says, Tnu lanu achas mehem, a group of Jews are together, and a non-Jew says, one of you give your life, v'nehargeu, and I'll kill you, v'imlav nehare kulchem, and if not, we'll kill all of you. What's the rule? This is also passed by the Raman Shulchan Aruch, and the Kufim and Zion, kulam, yehargu, all should be killed, v'am yimsum nefesh achas mitzvah. I can't specifically hand-deliver the life of one person. There's much Holocaust response literature about these situations where the Nazis would gather together hundreds, thousands of Jewish people, would ask for one person to give his life to save the entire group. The halacha is that is usher, and we know countless counts that we have of Jews, thousands of Jews whose lives were killed because one person did not give up his life. There are written testimony to these situations in the Tshuvas Mimamakim. There is particular tshuvas about this, and this is the Psak Halacha very clear. So if in Holocaust literature, and in Holocaust Halacha we see that was not the case, and Tnu Lanu Achas Mikem, to hand over the life of one individual for it, how are Luliness and Pupas able to give up their life for everybody else? So the Yeshua Yaakov admits his difficulty, and again, his thesis, his premise, his theory, is L'tovas on Shel Yisrael, for the good of the Jewish people is permitted. Now, the Jewish people were only in Lud. Were the Jews only living in Lud and Bayashani? Certainly not. So Yeshua Yaakov has a very broad definition of what Tovas and Shel Yisrael is. He understands that a city is called Tovas and Shel Yisrael. But how do we define it? So he goes on and explains, V'lama lo neima b'kan. Why do we not say here, Avsha melech helil al kulam? Even though the king was ratted to that everybody was worthy of the death penalty, V'hare kulam al yimsu nafsham. Shum nefesh Yisrael, it's one Jew. Umali nefesh yichayish echad mali nafsham. How can it be that he was permitted to do such a thing? And now, the Yeshua Yaakov reiterates his point, elavadai d'afti mitzara din kenu. Even according to the letter of the law, Luliness and Pupas did not have to give their lives. He writes, im yirtzu latzu tavakazah. If you want to do this, shehi tovas klal Yisrael, for the good of the Jewish people, yecholim limsor nafsham. They can give their lives. V'ein aleim chet, and there's no sin. Left very, very difficult with the position of the Yeshua Yaakov. If they want to, they can. We never find a place in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, in Dine Yeharik Val Yavor, where if you want to do something, you can. L'tovas on yourself for the good of the Jewish people. There were 1,000 people, thousands of people, whose lives were at risk. Tovas on Shel Yisrael, but an equivalent amount of citizens that existed in the city of Lud. So if one wants to do that, to save the entire corpus of the Jewish people, according to the Yeshua Yaakov, that would be permitted. And he writes, you don't have to do a mikra din, but it's a very high and a wonderful act of heroism. Now, he admits that the Gemara itself says this. But again, how do you understand the Gemara? The Gemara seems to go slap in the face of the sources that we saw on page number 2. It's usher. It's prohibited to do such. If I have the flask of water, I can't give it to somebody else. What if I want to? It's not up to you. Your life is not in your hands. So how does the Yeshua of Yaakov have the right to posit that that is the situation, the understanding of the Gemara? Now, it's not just a question of the Yeshua of Yaakov. We have to understand the first source, the primary source, not the secondary source. How do you understand the Gemara about Harugei Avot? In a very lengthy tshuva, source number 12, Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, deals with this difficulty. He refers to the Yeshua of Yaakov in a different part of his responsa. And here he argues with the Yeshua of Yaakov, and he has a different theory how to understand source number 10, the case of Harugei Avot. Source number 12, this is in his Tshuva's Mishpat Kohen. Many of us are familiar with Cook from other areas of philosophy, but he has two, three volumes of very difficult, complicated Tshuva's. He did write a lot on these topics. So here is one snippet from Rav Cook's response on this particular situation. He writes, "Umuvda de Harugei Lud, regarding the case, the Gemara in Baba Basra, Harugei Lud, Shehevi Kvot Harasenu," he's referring to his correspondent, "Ein Raya, there's no proof. You cannot use the case of Harugei Lud as a justifiable text source to save another and to give your life to save somebody else. Afilah Salas Rabbi, even if it comes to saving thousands of Jews. The mutter limsor nafshu b'makom she'nechayev. I can't give up my life where I'm not permitted to. Sheyesh lomar, now Rav Kook says, the hasam im lo hayu he mekabla mamas v'gamkein, if they would not have risked their life, luliness and puppets themselves, hayu nehargim b'soch haklal, they would have been lifeless. They would have been dead. Anyway, the gzeir was upon the entire community, was on all of Lud, and they found themselves in the area of Lud. So therefore, if they would have not done anything, they also would have been taken to the death. Sharei Amalchus gozer ha-gzeira kol Yisrael, the gzeira, the decree, was given upon the entire city of Lud, u'bikiai gavner shebelav ha-chiyare, says Rav Kook, in a situation where regardless they would have been killed, hari ein kan mishum v'chai b'hem. The rule that my life precedes, supersedes, trumps your life does not exist when any way my life would have been taken. This is not similar to the case where the Nazis had a group and pointed to one person. There, that person was pointed to. In the situation of Lud, says Rav Kook, nobody was pointed to. They simply had a decree on the entire city. On Yud Gimel Kislev, they were going to come and they were going to wipe out the entire city of Lud. Luliness and puppets were going to be part of that decree. If they were going to be part of that decree, says Rav Kook, that situation permits them to go out of their way and to give their life as a result. And he continues, Upshita shemitzvah shel chassidus gedola hilim sornasha. It is a righteous act to sanctify your life in this particular situation. Even though there are rules and laws when I am able to do such a thing. Commentary. Everybody's life was at danger. Everybody's life was at risk. If I was in that situation, says Rav Kook, that permits luliness and puppets to give their life, because anyway, the entire gzeir was given to the entire Jewish people. Nobody's life was pointed to. Rav Kook reinterprets the Gemara in source number 10 of luliness and puppets and describes that as nothing to do with hatzalas klal Yisrael, saving the entire Jewish people. That's a very difficult term, very difficult way to understand what's permitted, what's not permitted. Rav Kook understands when anyway everybody's life is going to be taken, that permits one to give his life. So if we use this source to go back to what we find situation, if he knew, regardless, that his life was going to be taken away, if he saw a grenade being thrown at him, and all four soldiers' lives would have been given, in that particular situation, I believe, according to Rav Kook, Roei Klein was permitted to do what he did. Not only was he permitted to do what he did, but he falls in the category of what the Gemara says in source number 10. Ein kol birya yachol olam b'mechitzasim, he has nobody as a place in heaven, the likes of him, because he anyway was going to be killed. They didn't specifically throw the grenade at him. They would have thrown it at him and nobody else. They wanted him. Then maybe he would not have had permission. Maybe he would have thrown it at somebody else. He could have jumped in a different direction. But when the grenade was thrown at a group of people, at 100 people, at 10 people, 50 people, 60 people, and anyway his life was going to be taken, according to Rav Kook, that would permit him to jump on the grenade, and it puts him in a place in heaven that nobody had. Source number 13 is a fascinating one. Rabbi Waldenberg, in his Tshuva Tzitz Eliezer, Waldenberg was the chief rabbi of the Shari Tzedek Hospital, and he had, his tshuvas are frightening, they can make you cry, the difficulty questions that were brought his direction. And he often deals with situations on the front line. And this particular question that was asked of him was regarding a few combatants who were found on the front lines in the army. And one soldier was injured in a very, very poorly, and was a very bad situation. The question was, can other soldiers who are now on free land, who were safe, go back to try to save this soldier who is in a very bad situation? Terrible question that we should never have to face, but Rabbi Waldenberg had to answer these questions. They were real questions. Should a soldier, a group of soldiers, two, three soldiers, go back, try to go back, putting themselves in a suffix sakana, like we dealt with in source number 3 of the Sma, are they permitted to go back to try to save that soldier, putting their own lives at risk? My Waldenberg has a tremendous, tremendous chiddush. He opens up with much of the literature that we've discussed, pointing to the Sma, suffix sakana, and his early first half of his response posits that it's prohibited, that the soldiers, the three soldiers or four soldiers that are now on Israeli side of the border should not go back into the other side of the border to try to take their friend, their colleague, their comrade out of the situation that he's in. He'll have to perish there on his own. He then takes an about face and says something startling. Take a look at source number 13. Of Al-Batsirufim Kol Asher Birayinu La'el, based upon everything that I've written until this point, Baruch HaDavar, Shein Komak Mechalik Bekach. There is no disagreement with what I am about to say. Eladin HaTorah, the rule according to the Torah, Hu Shabil Milchama, Ubestei Karev, in a war, or in a situation where you are on a battlefield, Ein Din Shel Bechai Behev. The rule of Rabbi Akiva, that my life supersedes somebody else's life, no longer applies. That rule is off limits. When it comes to war, a war situation, when it comes to the front lines, when it comes to a battlefield, the rule of Achai Behem, the biblical commandment that my life precedes somebody else's, no longer applies. Vein din shel chayecha kovin. Rabbi Akiva's ruling that my life trumps yours. If I have the bottle of water, if I'm on the front lines and I'm safe now, I've returned to safe territory, that rule does not apply. Chayecha kotman. Elik Hashem Shaposek Rambam. Time is late. I don't want to read the entire passage in the Tzitz Eliezer. He refers to a position of the Rambam that when it comes to war, we do whatever we can. And a soldier who is on the front lines has to forget about his wife. He has to obliterate her from his memory. He can't think about his children. He is an individual, very passionate line of the Rambam, worthwhile to see inside. When it comes to a soldier has to be focused on exactly the battle that he is in front of him and on nothing else. As such, says Rabbi Waldenberg, I have to leave behind all of my wishes and desires when it comes to being on the front line. My life is not my life. My life is the life of my comrades. We are all one unit. I'm not Moshe, you're not David, you're not Shlomo. We are a team, we are a group of people. We are one organism, one body. I must give up my life to save somebody else's when it comes to war. Even when I'm certainly going to put myself into a situation of suffix sakana, I know that I can't make it back. We discussed the smasha that that's prohibited. The Meshech Chachma, Moshe Rabbeinu did not have to return to Egypt. If he knew that he had a situation where he was going to be killed, he didn't have to save the Jewish people. But says Rabbi Waldman, when it comes to a war, it's not only when a soldier was shot in the heart and he's bleeding, do I have to certainly go back? Even when he was shot in the arm or the leg, I still have to go back and try to save his life. Maybe I could wait 2 days, 3 days, and when things settle down, we could go back and we can send in an airlift to try to remove him. Says Rabbi Waldenberg, when it comes to war, that's not the case. I have to put my life online for my friends, for my colleagues, for my comrades, for my combatants, because that's what war tells and teaches about. The rule of the Chai Behem no longer exists. It's a startling chiddush of Rabbi Waldenberg. He then goes on in a very poetic way to try to ask God that we should never see such a situation. We ask Hashem that we should never see such a situation. But he paskins halacha l'maisa, and I would imagine that this is something that the Israeli army follows, that all soldiers must do whatever they can to protect their friends, not only when their friend is in a safek sakana or a vadai sakana, whatever the situation is, they must do whatever they can to save them. So although, to be honest, and to be intellectually honest, Rabbi Waldenberg is not dealing with a Roe Klein situation where a person jumps specifically on top of a grenade, I would like to extrapolate that he would also permit the same thing. If when it comes to war, when it comes to the front lines, the din of a chaybahem no longer exists, the Roe Klein as well, although he's certainly going to die, he's certainly going to be killed. We know for a fact that would seem to teach, that would seem to posit, along with the Gemara and Baba Basra and Maseches and Daf Yud, that he is applauded and he is given great high accolades, not only here, but as well as in heaven for doing what he did. The final source, source number 14, is a psak of Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. Rabbi Zilberstein is a Rav, a son-in-law of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who in Bnei Brak, and he has many, many responsa on also a very complicated and difficult matter. And he here specifically has an essay and a responsa where he's dealing with the World Trade Center case that we began with in source number 4. Was their ability, or was the fact that they tried putting the plane down, say it was going to the White House, was that permitted? Were they allowed to do that? Could they steer the plane off its position, of its area, of its direction, in order to save hundreds, if not thousands, of people in that building when they know they will be killed? Rabbi Zilberstein has very clear words about that. Source number 14, Al Kol Panim Nira, he writes, Shikaimu Nosei Hamatos Atzma Mis Mitzvah Fiyatashti. Those who were aboard Flight 93 from San Francisco to Washington are applauded and are have fulfilled the mitzvah of Nikdashti to sanctify God's name. Ilu yinkitu pu'ula shetavi l'risuk o hispotetus hamatos. If they are to help arrange, organize a situation where the plane would have been put down, where the plane would have been destroyed, al menas lahatzil es achem shebemigdal, in order to save their friends in the Migdal, here he's referring to specifically the Twin Towers, that would have been permitted, that would have been mutter, not only mutter, they fulfilled the mitzvah of Nikdashti Espanei Yisrael, steering the plane off its regular route, as opposed to where it was headed, that is a great activity, and his proof is from source number 10, Keshem Shelulinus Supapus Nergu B'Shvil Hatzelus Am Yisrael, just like Lulinus and Papus gave their lives in order to save the Jewish people, V'ein Kobir Yechol Olavu Mechitzasa, nobody has had their status, their place in heaven. So from the three sources that we just saw, source 14, 13, and 12, Rav Kook, Rabbi Waldenberg, Rabbi Zilberstein, all seem to be on the same page, and all seem to have the same conclusion that for different reasons, if it's Rabbi Waldenberg's reason for milchama, war, front lines, battlefield, army, has a whole different status, the rule of a chaybem, Rabbi Kiva no longer applies, and as such, the actions that we read about on the first page are given tremendous place in heaven because of what they did, that's a war. Or according to Rav Kook, when the Gzeira is given to entire community, the entire Jewish people, their life is at stake, and I have not been pointed to, an individual has not been pointed to anyway, the entire city would have been put aflame, just like Roe Klein when he jumped on the grenade was headed at the entire group, says Rav Kook that that is permitted, and again, Ein Kol Birya Yechol Olam B'Mechitzasam. We're left with a difficulty trying to understand the Yeshua's Yaakov in terms of how he understood Hatzalat Klal Yisrael, saving the Jewish people. That's a bit more difficult, certainly in terms of the halachic literature that we discussed. What is called Hatzalat Klal Yisrael? What's not called Hatzalat Klal Yisrael? Maybe saving four Jews in the army is also called Klal Yisrael. The Jewish people need the army. Without the army, I don't know. But regardless, on paper, it seems to me that based on sources 12, 13, and 14, we have very, very clear directive from the great Poskei Zmanenu that the actions which were done and were fulfilled, certainly by the private officer McGinnis, where we climb the hero of the Jewish people of the last decade for his actions which he created, should serve as a memory to them. This year should be dedicated in his memory. Hashem should protect him and his family, and we should see Mirz Hashem no more sorrow. Klal Yisrael should find themselves in a situation where we only see Dvarim Tovim. Hopefully we can speak about fonder topics, more interesting topics, and more pleasant topics, but I do think it's important to recognize that halachic authorities do have to deal with difficult situations, and you see that these questions are asked to them, they're answered, And as far as I am aware, these are the directives which the Army is given in terms of how to go about dealing with these difficult situations. I'm happy to stay around for questions. If people want to go, you can. Yeah. There are earlier stories where we heard of such cases. I mean, Chazal often talk about cases. Adam Rishon gave up years of his life. Chazal have other midrashim that certain biblical figures gave up years of their life for somebody else's life. There's no clear answer to that question. You do hear of such stories. I don't know the veracity of that story. I don't know. Not that I'm aware of. I don't know how that's permitted.
Moshe Rabbeinu killing the Mitzri to begin with was an act that he was coming from. So there must have been some sort of differentiation between him going back
in
Mitzrayim, after how much people died
in Mitzrayim.
So putting himself in that
original
position anyway.
So like I point out, in Simon Tov Chavav, the Rishonim always point out that if we're going to be so exacting in what we're going to do, so a civilization and a society cannot exist, because if you're just going to allow everything to crumble and there's no officer, a cop, an army, everybody's putting themselves into some situation of sakana. So there are rules. I can't put myself into a vadai sakana. If I don't know how to swim, it's prohibiting me from jumping. That's a suicide mission. If I sort of know how to swim, then I have to do that. That's where the gray line is. But Moshe Rabbeinu's actions certainly get us off to an understanding of who Moshe Rabbeinu was. Yeah.
In the time of war, then there are certain rules that apply and other rules that don't apply. Today, we are in a war, we've been in a war, it's called fourth generation war, and the warfare where they're fighting not a street enemy, it's not a battlefield. It's Islam, it's a world war. To what extent do these rules hold?
That today, contemporary post-war discussed this heavily. Are we in a... is this called the war that we're fighting? Is it a Muhammad mitzvah? Is it a certainly it's not a Muhammad chovah? But what ramifications does that have upon the citizens of Israel is often discussed, and it's a very interesting one. How we deal with that, there's a full gamut of literature discussing that, what the status of the Israel has today in their situation. Is it called a sakana? Is it a suffix sakana? It's an important question that's dealt with. Yeah. Yeah.
Did he put himself
with the Dever?
Huh?
With Dever.
Yeah,
with
Dever. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he put himself in that
to Yeah, Post can discuss that case also. Post can discuss the case of Aaron. There are numerous cases that we could use from biblical literature trying to decide how to glean cases. But again, was Aaron in a Vaday Sakana? Contemporary, the question that Rabbi Waldenberg himself deals with. Visiting a patient, you're a doctor. A doctor visiting a patient who has particular diseases. Diseases that are terminal, diseases that could be caught. So does the doctor have a responsibility to take care of that patient? So according to Halacha, could be not. Rabbi Waldenberg also says that how can we live our lives if doctors are not servicing their patients? We're just going to watch a civilization crumble. So you're right. Although there are, the letter of the law would tell me that I shouldn't put myself into a sakana. Maybe a doctor can. That's his position. A doctor can. A visitor shouldn't. If you're a general biker cholim who sends visitors to visit hospitals, so you shouldn't send patients to that ward because you're putting yourself in a dangerous situation. But a doctor most certainly has to and has the right and the commanded v'rapo yirape. Yeah. No, it's a good question. There's no din of kibbutz im by v'chai b'hem. V'chai b'hem means that my life has precedence. So even though there are other rules, it's called arye raviole, there are other mitigating factors that exist, Rabbi Akiva never differentiates between a man, a woman, a child, somebody who's not shomer Torah mitzvos. If I have that bottle of water belongs to me, I don't have to give it up.
And for the case of Moshe, what's the definition of a wall?
What's the definition of a war? That's the similar question that was asked here. Contemporarily, I mentioned. That's a tremendous novel approach of the Mesher Chachma. It's a tremendous novel approach of the Mesher Chachma. He proves it from the position of the Rambam, that once you're safe, you don't have to put yourself into another situation to save others. That's his position. You're right. It is a Chiddush. It seems to be not followed the Halacha. That's the way he describes the pasuk, but he doesn't just say it homiletically in order to describe the pasuk. He says it lahalacha. Even if Sar Tzava Yisrael, Yoav ben Tzruya, was found in the city of refuge, he did not have to leave. He doesn't have to put himself into a suffix sakana. Yeah. Yeah, but we'll speak to that by winter.
Okay.
It would be my honor.
You said it's not an interesting topic. It's a fascinating topic.
Okay. I'd be more than happy to discuss it. Yes.
All the general Warsaw. And the Jewish community and the underground person would say, don't turn me over, this is not right. And they would turn him over because they're afraid for their life. And the truth is, the Nazis would kill that person. And then they'd also kill the rest of the Jewish people because they were lying all along.
That's right.
But it's not in keeping with the story you told of nobody volunteering.
That's going to be a third lecture. That's going to be the third lecture.
Ah, okay.
Because the Gemara says when it comes, if somebody's life was pointed to, if the Nazi said that we want this person specifically, or the Gemara deals with Achitofel, he had a death sentence regardless, and now the warring nation comes and says we're going to kill him, if any way he had the death sentence to him, then you're able to turn him over. If any way this person was deemed worthy of death by the Israeli society, where he had a death sentence on him, it was only a matter of weeks. Okay, that's correct. That's correct. That's the problem. Anytime you're dealing with an enemy, how do you use halacha, which is written in a very explicit way, when dealing with people who are, we're not sure if they're going to listen to us or not, is very, very difficult to know. If you're interested, Rabbi Oshri, many of his responses were translated to English, me makim, from my depth, he has, you could cry just reading the questions. If on Tisha B'Av, we shouldn't have this. If you want something to really feel the churban, read the questions that the Jewish people ask him. Mika Amcha Yisrael is unbelievable. That people in this such difficult situations were asking questions of the like is astounding and startling. Yeah. Yes, so that's exactly what the Shuas Yaakov says. He says, Hatzalas Klal Yisrael Shani, to save the entire Jewish people. Save two people. Okay. It's a very good question. That's the fourth lecture. The Chazon Ish has this suffix in his Sefer. He, later also, Ephesus, somebody by the name of Felipe Foot, she copied, I don't know if she took it from him, but she has a very similar question. Called the runaway train. If a train is headed toward one person, it's going to kill one individual, or a group of six, seven individuals, can the person is being noheg the train, turn the train in order to kill one person? Is that permitted or not? The train is headed in one direction to kill 10, 15 people. If he makes the right turn, he'll kill one person. That's the question that the Chazon Ish deals with. He has four lines about that question. Oh, everybody tries to understand exactly what the Chazon Ish means. Yeah?
The question of two people walking in the wilderness seems to depend upon one of those people being an actual possession.
Absolutely.
Of the
flesh. Absolutely.
And do you think that is a reflection of bowing to the circumstance that person happens to have flesh? Or is it actually a question of kind of a property right?
Just articulate again your question. You're asking now.
What is the basis for a Akiva's decision?
Okay.
Is it because he happens to have flesh? Or is it because it is his flesh? might it be different if they're walking along and they both spotted the flag?
Okay. That's a good question. What I referred to earlier, third-party life-saving, contemporarily, organ transplantation. This was the case in Israel. Rabbi Herzog actually asked Moshe Feinstein, the penicillin vaccine came to Israel, and there are only about 1,000 vaccinations. Who should be permitted to take that vaccine? Very complicated question. When there are only a certain amount of lungs available. So who is permitted, who is there rules of hierarchy? Like I said, Moshe, if it belongs to me, like Rabbi Kiva said, if the flask of water belongs to me, it's mine. I don't have the right to give it up. Rabbi Kiva posits the way he does because his bottle of water belongs to him. If now two people are walking the desert and now one person comes with an Evian bottle, he has to decide between two people. That's a complicated question. That's the question. The Chidush Erim, that's the Ger Rebbe, the first Ger Rebbe in his parish on Bava Mitzvah here, he has a debate and he tries to glean what would be the case in that situation based upon Rabbi Kiva and Ben Petura. But contemporarily, as I mentioned, that is a question that exists in hospitals. Ethicists, rabbis are handling these questions, unfortunately, daily. When there's a list of people who are waiting for a transplant, can I jump the line? Can I pay $1 million for the person who's first in line to take that? That's a question. Yeah. If it comes to davening for somebody, we know that the tefillos work, so that's something that we should do. If
everybody
yeah, if rabbis instituted that, and
it seems like people nay up from doing that,
would be inappropriate.
It's inappropriate and against all the
halachas. When it comes to davening, there are many ways that a person can daven. Sometimes there's a tefillos rabbim, sometimes there's a tefillos yachid. There are different ways to pray for people.
But when you have an official policy not to do it, that seems
right. It could be it's a political issue that typically when tefillos were ordained, if we go back to the 19th century, early 18th century, so tefillah was an area that was usually used to move away in a certain way. Rosh Shimshon Verhirsch classically, when he took the reform to task, one of the reasons that he did so because they changed the prayer service. That was something. So throughout Jewish history, I think rabbis were always concerned when you implement tefillos, when you say tefillos that are not classically those of Anshei Knesset Sagdola, that's when we get nervous. I'm not making a statement, yes to say it, not to say it, but it could be that would be the second way to look at it. If a certain group, a tzibur, a rabbin institutes a particular prayer, so then clearly that's what should be done. Today we don't have a melech, we don't have a kohen gadol. So if your rabbi, your rabbanim, or a group of rabbanim ordained a particular tefillah, so that's something you should say. But there are a lot of things that rabbis say, nobody listens to them anyway.
Yeah. Since they make Mishabarach in general for various things, you know, even if somebody is
older or we certainly know that in Germany or in Europe, the Mishabarach for the host country that we were living in was commonplace. Franz Joseph, sure, there are certainly plenty of skills that were ordained. So there is certainly a precedent for it. Yeah? Yeah. Meaning, if you're not in the situation at all. The guy jumped?
The guy jumped back.
When he didn't have to do that. So, look, again, you could go with the Tzitzilezer and say that's a war, and it's the front lines. Anytime you're on the front line, so you're one guf echad. The Meshech Chachma, for example, one of the ways I usually typically explain the Meshech Chachma is that Moshe Rabbeinu was not in Mitzrayim. He didn't have to go back to Mitzrayim. If Moshe Rabbeinu was in Mitzrayim, then maybe he would have had to fight. He would have had to put himself in a situation of sakana. But because Moshe was in Midian, far away from everything, maybe he didn't have to. But to jump back in, so certainly according to the Tzitz Eliezer would be permitted. And then one asks the question, you're right. In a situation where you're not there, should you jump back in? Vaday sakana. If that's the drowning case, if I am going to drown and I'm standing watching somebody, I do not have to do that. But if I'm in a war, if I it's a suicide mission. It's a suicide mission. And you know, so you have that's where it gets gray. In a house that's burning, you have the potential to save them because you're going into a house. You know how to run. You know how to walk. You know how to move. When I'm running into water and I don't know how to drown, it's a suicide mission. It's possible that that's not a suicide mission.
Actually, the majority of people who try to save drowning people in the sea, drown themselves.
They don't know how.
The question out there is drowning.
Right. So, but like I pointed out, we always have to... A suicide mission, possibly. Yeah, maybe this will be the last question. I see time is late. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Cook explained that the nectar of the Meruge wood is because they themselves were in the sakana of being killed. But what about Esther Hamalka,
yeah,
who seemingly was safe? She didn't know she was doing it, and yet she still risked her life to save her.
Yeah, so Gemara says it could be she was Sheva Al Tasa, she was Karka Olam. You're right. It's a good question. It's discussed also. It is brought as a question. Yeah, we have to read the psukim better in the Megillah. If you what you are debating is some of the things that the sources debate when it comes to Esther. But again, early sources discuss Esther. So. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Rabbi Walter, for your powerful words and presentation. We look forward, Rabbi Walter, with your permission, scheduling lecture 2, 3, 4. And we all hope and pray that some of these very difficult questions should never befall us or Klal Yisrael. Mr. Kaya, thank you everybody for coming. You're welcome to
29 is closed.
Yeah.
I should make public service announcements.
You know which way?
If human has something to